Thank you, Mr. Green. Good afternoon to everybody. I hope you're enjoying your Sabbath day. This is a continuation of a sermon on the Beatitudes. Someone asked me how many I'm going to go. Hopefully today and one more, especially looking at the schedule. It kind of makes sense to try to wrap up in January. But as a quick reminder, as far as what we've covered so far, when addressing the multitudes, Jesus Christ started off with the Sermon on the Mount by covering these Beatitudes. And if you think of what was going on at the time, a combination of the influence of the Roman Empire as well as the leadership at the time, the Jewish leadership at the time that ran Palestine. Because if you remember your history, world history from high school or college, the Romans, when they would take over a territory or sack a territory, they would allow for local rulership as long as it was in line with what the Romans wanted. So there was a local Israeli or Jewish leadership over the area, and the leadership was not consistent with what we see in the scriptures. So in giving his sermon and preparing his disciples, I believe Jesus Christ was, in essence, setting the mind. You know, how do these disciples, and then by extension us, how do we need to think about and focus on who to be and how to mirror our or model our behavior? And we see then as we started going through the Beatitudes, and we started off with those that are poor in spirit, those who are submissive to God in God's ways. Those who are not so haughty that they're willing to listen. They're willing to learn, whether it be from each other, from the scriptures, from the ministry, whomever it might be, and that we need to have the proper freedom of mind to be able to learn and to grow from each other and from the scriptures. And that those who mourn or those who take things seriously in the situation we find ourselves in. So then we'll continue then with the next. If you turn with Matthew 5, turn to Matthew 5, we will read the next beatitude. In Matthew 5 and verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I read from the New American Standard, and its translation is, blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. But we'll talk about meek, because this is what I'm used to, I think most people are used to. We can have a negative connotation of the word meek if we're not careful. I believe the world has a negative connotation of the word meek. When we think of meek, we think what? Meek as a mouse? Or meek being weak? If you said, there goes Sally or Joe, and they're meek, and you said it in today's connotation or today's vernacular, it would not necessarily be considered a compliment. What is meant by meek? The word meek translates from the Greek word praeus, P-R-A-I-E-S. This particular Greek word is only used four times in the New Testament. Once in, obviously, the Beatitudes. Let's look at the others. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 29. Matthew 11, verse 29, we'll actually begin in 28, where it says, come to me, Jesus Christ speaking here, obviously, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am praeus, I am meek, I am gentle in this particular translation, and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Matthew 21, and verse 5 is the third time it is used, again by Matthew. Matthew 21 and verse 5. Say to the daughter of Zion, Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, gentle, and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. Once again, Jesus described as being gentle or meek, praeus. What does that mean? You think of some of the drawings when you see of Jesus Christ or artist depiction of Jesus Christ. He's often drawn as a small and demure and what, once again, today's connotation of meek. And one more, let's look at 1 Peter, the only time this used by someone other than Matthew. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4. First Peter chapter 3 and verse 4, breaking in, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. Gentle and quiet. Meek should not or does not equal quiet, because then why would Peter list the two different adjectives? Gentle or meek. What is meant by meek? Once again, it's only used four times. So it would be helpful to reflect what meek or praeus is not. What is meek? What it is not? And then we'll look at more what it is. You know, meek is not a leadership type, in essence of, you know, when you talk about type A. Well, someone is aggressive, someone's popular, someone is well spoken, someone is good looking, and or they have this, you know, this je ne sais quoi, you know, something about them that just makes them that quintessential leader. Or the type A driving personality. And as I mentioned before, today's vernacular isn't synonymous with weakness. Needless to say, you know, if Jesus Christ describes himself as being meek, it's worth exploring. And if he says we should be meek, what does it mean? Is he saying that we should be weak? Looking at, once again, the Greek word, if we now look at how that Greek word is used in other literature, contemporary literature, in the first centuries, at the time of the first century church, the beginning of the church, and how Matthew or Peter would be using this, if we look at similar literature, praeus can be also be translated as not being overly impressed with one's self-importance. Not being overly impressed by a sense of one's self-importance. Does that apply to Jesus Christ? Yes. Jesus Christ is to be King of Kings. He is going to be given authority of all earth. But he submits to his Father and to his Father's will. Even Jesus Christ is not overly impressed with his own self-importance, because he was acting on the will on the behest of his Father. Used in ancient secular literature, praeus can also imply a balance. Is that how we see Jesus Christ? Someone who is balanced. So someone who's not overly impressed with their own self-importance, and someone who is balanced. Is that how we see Jesus Christ as well? Through the scriptures, I would hold out, yes, we do. A balance of submission and forceful leadership as an example. Let's look at a couple examples there. One of strength, of action. Turning over the tables in the temples from the money changers. Definitely wasn't weak. Definitely wasn't quiet. But he was very forceful in his activity. Or how about his forcefulness of conviction against the Pharisees and the scribes? He was not shy calling them vipers, a view of Satan. He's taking the leadership directly on. He's not being quiet. He's not being weak. He's being very forceful. But then we balance that with how he dealt with a woman caught in adultery. He had every, I would say, right to come out strong and say, how do you defile my father's ways? And you should keep the commandments, which he did. But he came in a sense or in a way, in a balance of someone wanting to teach, someone wanting to train. We see examples of that balance in Jesus Christ. The balance of when, where, and why. For your reference, Matthew 26, where when Jesus Christ was about to be crucified, what did Jesus say when his disciples wanted to defend him? He said, I could call down legions of angels. I have the power to inflict. I have the power to do so much if that was my Father's plan. But it was not the time and the place to do that. We all know there will be time in the future when he will come riding his white horse. He will do battle against those who will want to, you know, who will not want to submit to God's ways. But it was not the time. It was not the place. It's a balance of when and where and why. We were in a Bible study last night in Kenosha. The topic was how a Christian's response to being a bully. And what should we do? How should we respond to someone who wants to bully us? And it was interesting, the discussion and the answers, but one of the key takeaways was that it really depends on the situation. It depends on, you know, how should we respond, depends on who's in harm's way and what the situation is. And it's a balance of, and it's a spiritual wisdom of what to do, when, where, and why. So if we think about this Greek term or this Greek word praeus, and we think about being meek, Jesus Christ being meek, being described as meek, and he wants us to be meek. He doesn't want us to be weak. He doesn't want us to be powerless. He doesn't want us to be pushovers. He doesn't want us to be quiet. But I like this particular translation or this Greek word when we think about someone who is, first of all, once again, not overly taken with their own self-importance. Because, think of the power that the disciples would have. The power to heal. The power to do miracles. The power to represent the coming Messiah. And the instructions were to the disciples was, don't get filled up with your own importance. But I want you to be balanced. I want you to be balanced how you approach your work and your effort. This is what God is looking for. When he says those who are meek, they shall inherit the earth. You know, that's who God is looking for to inherit the earth, to help guide in the millennium and then the world tomorrow and God's reign here on earth. He's looking for people of balance, of when to know and how to rightly apply God's word. Meekness doesn't look for revenge. Meekness is not provoked by detractors. Meekness allows for the shortcomings of others. Now, a balanced response is a righteous response. So blessed are the meek, the balanced, for they shall inherit the earth. Continuing then on the next verse, or the next beatitude. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm missing a page here. So let's look at Psalms 37. Psalms chapter 37. And verse 10. Psalms chapter 37 and verse 10. Beginning actually in verse 7, Psalms 37 and verse 7, rest in the eternal and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. In essence, be balanced. For evildoers will cut off, but those who wait for the eternal will inherit the land. Yet a little while, and a wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. Those who are patient will inherit the land. The meek, those who are balanced. You see the type of response that David was talking about in his psalm, and how one responds. And for your reference, Revelation 20, verse 7, that we will be a kingdom of priests. It's God's will that he bring many sons to glory, and he wants to have a meek and balanced individual to help teach the whole world his ways. It's an application of God's way and trying to learn how to apply. I remember a story on an approach that I took back when I used to work in the canoeing crew up in Orr, Minnesota at a church summer camp way back when I was a college student. Not as far back as when Mr. Burns gave his first Spokesman's Club speech. Not that far back, but still. I was a college student and I was not much older than some of these teenage boys. And some of them, you know, a lot of testosterone going, and who are you to tell me what to do? And so we would spend a little time with the dorm before we head out on a canoe trip on the bus ride out. And I would learn to pretty quickly pick up on those who I know would maybe be a bit of a battle. Maybe butting heads. And my approach could be twofold. I could go at him headstrong, tell him who's boss, tell him what's for. Something tells me, though, that wouldn't be really effective. Not good timing. So what I would do instead was I would wait till we get to our first portage, when we'd have to carry all of our gear around a waterfall or through rocks or narrow spots, and some of these portages may be half a mile long, and we'd have to put our gear on our back, and then some of the bigger guys we'd pick up the canoes, two people in a canoe, and carry it over our heads, and we'd portage for a half a mile or a mile that way. And so I'd pick out the one that I'd feel that, you know, might give me a little bit of problems, and I would say, hey, I tell you what, why don't you and I take this canoe? So I would get in front, he would get in back, we'd put it on our back, and I would book. I would go as quick as I can. And we'd finish up, and we'd take the canoe off, and inside, I'd be dying. I'd be ready to just fall over sideways. But I obviously, I wouldn't show it. I'd take it off and say, oh, man, that was so much fun. Let's do it again. And no, Mr. And it's amazing how effective that worked, just to combination of gain the respect and handle those who were maybe a bit more headstrong. It's a balance of learning how to address and approach people who need help, or who do need guidance, who do need coaching or need mentoring. And that's what a meek person does, is someone who learns to not be filled with their own importance, but a balance. Okay. Now, continuing on to the next beatitude, in verse 6. Beatitude number 4. We read, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Or in some translations, they shall be satisfied. The first three Beatitudes focus on the proper frame of mind. Jesus now seems to instruct on our focus and activities. What do we do? Talk about having a humility. Talk about taking things seriously. Talking about having a balance and being meek. Now we say what to do. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. It's not enough to have the gifts. So we need to demonstrate. We need to act. The concept of hungering and thirsty is quite forward. I don't want to spend too much time on that, except to note that the Greek for filled or satisfied is passive. In other words, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled, or shall be satisfied. they shall be filled. That's passive, as having happened, having take place. Not if you pursue righteousness, you may be blessed. But the act of hungering and thirsting, just the act of hungering and thirsting, leads to being satisfied. So interesting phrasing and use of grammar there by Matthew in quoting Jesus Christ. So I like to spend my time, though, during talking about this particular beatitude by looking at the term righteousness. Righteousness comes from the Greek dikaiosyne, D-I-K-A-I-S-Y-N-E, for those of you who love those Greek words. Once again, translates to righteousness. There's quite a variety of views from the commentaries on what does righteousness mean. Some confuse it with God's gift of salvation. As a matter of fact, some go to, I think, great theological gymnastics to bend and twist and turn, trying to redefine the term to mean sanctification or to apply it to, in essence, we have already achieved righteousness. I don't particularly read that. Righteousness, by the way, is not an adjective, but it's a noun. It's a noun. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Not being righteous, but for righteousness. So what is righteousness? Once again, looking at a Greek lexicon, a dictionary, that particular Greek word is the quality, state, or practice of judicial responsibility. The quality, state, or practice of judicial responsibility with focus on fairness. A focus on fairness. Also justice, equitableness, fairness, sound judgment. A second definition is quality or state of judicial correctness with focus on redemptive action. In this case, focus on redemptive action or the act of righteousness. The key is the fairness, equitableness. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness hunger and thirst for equitableness. Fairness. That is God's ways. Through and through, pure. God's ways are righteousness. When we are to seek righteousness, we're not seeking it for our own righteousness. It's not our own righteousness, it is God's righteousness. Let's look at Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20. Same use of the Greek word here, Matthew 5 and verse 20. We'll look at three different uses here towards the end of chapter 5 and getting into chapter 6. Still continuing, and this is all part of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus Christ says in Matthew 5, verse 20, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Here in talking to the disciples and those who had gathered around, their judgment, their understanding, if it did not surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees, will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Once again, it's a pretty strong statement in that the scribes and Pharisees was part of that leadership. Not civil leadership, but they exerted great influence. And then Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1, Jesus says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them, otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." Once again, your righteousness. But then we see the contrast of talking about a human being's righteousness and what their perception of righteousness was then in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33. Matthew 6, 33, but it says, "But seek you first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." We see the contrast then of when we talk about righteousness and judgment, that we can have a righteousness or a judgment that is our own. And we have righteousness and judgment that is Jesus Christ. That is God the Father's, I should say. As Jesus Christ is in submission to his Father. It's God's law, it's God's ways. It's his commandments that define pure righteousness that we are to hunger and seek, not our own understanding and righteousness. Now, obviously, when you think about judicial and judgment, it's God's teaching of judicial, not our own perception. When you think about judicial judges, maybe you see a little conflict with some of today's rulings. There was, I'm not sure why I didn't notice this before, but this past week, a federal court of appeals put a stay on a law that was passed by the California legislature and signed into law by Governor Brown. The law, state law passed, puts a ban on licensed therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and other mental health professionals to teach or to use or to train. I'm sorry, the words are not coming to me here. To provide therapy on to change sexual orientation. So if a parent, I'm sorry, for minors or teenagers or kids, children. So if a parent wanted to provide or help provide training and take their child to a psychologist, that any particular therapy discussions that would contrast against allowing them to continue and their belief of attraction toward the same sex would result in discipline by the licensing agents in the state of California. So I was looking at this further. I thought it was kind of descriptive of where society is going today. The lower court, by the way, did not carry up the appeal by those who had filed suit against the law, stating that, well, you can't show that parents or therapists' First Amendment rights are being denied. So therefore, she allowed the law to stay, but then the three-judge panel is taking it up and put a stay on it. But as I continue to read and about this particular law, I was reading a quote from Exodus, who is an organization that helps provide counseling and support for those who are battling urges that are contrary to God's way. And they provide support and help. Well, lately, that particular president of Exodus, the president, Alan Chambers, has kind of got himself in a little bit of hot water with many of the group because he's commenting about the ongoing challenges that those who even are battling homosexuality, that the challenges that they'll face the rest of their lives. And so he has a quote that when I read it twice, and I thought, it's pretty insightful, but pretty descriptive. "I believe that any sexual expression outside of heterosexual monogamous marriage is sinful according to the Bible," Mr. Chambers emphasized. Very good. "But we've been asking people with same-sex attractions to overcome something in a way that we don't ask of anyone else," he said. noting that Christians with other sins, whether heterosexual lust, pornography, pride, or gluttony, do not receive the same blanket condemnations. I believe Mr. Chambers is right. If we think about today's mainstream Christianity, and it seems like now the just acceptance of our own righteousness, acceptance of our own interpretation of God's ways, and our own classifying of what is a sin or what's not a sin, or this sin is really bad, this sin is really bad, but this sin, well, as long as you don't hurt anybody, we'll overlook it. Do we not see that today? In today's society, in today's Christianity? I believe Mr. Chambers is spot on, even though he's got himself into big trouble. When we look at God's righteousness, it's 100% God's way, God's righteousness. Our righteousness is our own interpretation of what we think we should believe or not believe. When we hunger and thirst, we should hunger and thirst for what is right, 100%. Let's look at Romans chapter 3 and verse 12. Romans chapter 3 and verse 12. Actually, we'll begin in verse 9. Romans 3 and verse 9, what then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged them, both Jews and Greeks, all under sin, as it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside together. They have become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues, they just keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths, and in the path of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. This describes those who look to our own righteousness. And in verse 23, we read that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And for your reference, another memory scripture, no need to turn there, but Jeremiah 17:9, there is a way that seems right to man, but it's evil in God's eyes. When we talk about hungering and thirst for righteousness, what are we hungering and thirsting for? Because if we're not careful when we read this, we think about righteousness being an adjective to describe us. Well, I should try harder. I should beat myself up more. I should hunger and thirst so that I become righteous. Righteous is not an adjective. Righteousness is a noun. Righteousness describes God's way. That's what we should be hungering and pursuing, so that as we hunger and as we're pursuing and as we're thirsting for God's righteousness, then we become fulfilled as it having taken place. The Pharisees pursued their own brand, their own righteousness, their own definition of perfection that led them away from God's righteousness. We don't hunger and thirst for our own perceived glory, but for the glory of God. So again, Jesus Christ is preparing the disciples. And a lot of these parables and telling this is the way you should model yourself. This is how you should be is in direct contrast to what we see with the Pharisees. In essence, he's giving them the warning, understanding human nature. I don't want you to go this way, because look how they've done. Look at the results. Look at the fruits. This is how I want you to go. Bless those who are hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. The next beatitude, then, verse 9, beatitude number 5. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Let's begin this beatitude by looking at three words related to the concept of compassion and mercy. The first word that can be translated as compassion comes from the Greek word oikteirmos, O-I-K-T-I-R-M-O-S, oikteirmos, defined once again as a compassion or mercy, or a display of concern over misfortune. A display of concern over misfortune. Let's look at a couple examples. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort. Comfort, in this case, comfort. 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 3. Oikteirmos, I should say. God of all comfort. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 2. Actually, it's not comfort, I'm sorry, it's mercy. Mercy is in comfort. It's mercy that's translated oikteirmos. Anyway, Colossians chapter 3 and verse 2. I wrote down the wrong verse. So oikteirmos is a display of concern over in misfortune or a misfortune. So for example, you would have compassion if you see an animal caught in a trap. If you see a child that bruises their knee and you have pity, you have concern, you have and compassion, that's oikteirmos. It's a form of mercy, of compassion. The second Greek word, I won't even try to pronounce it. I'm not sure what the Greek equivalent of a two-bit word is, but this is it. It's S-P-L-A-G-C-H-N-I-Z-O-M-A-I. But it's to feel sympathy or to have pity. It's only used twice in the New Testament, one of which is the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son. When the son had returned and the son went out and had compassion, same Greek word, to feel sympathy, to have pity. The interesting though, the root word comes from the Greek word S-P-L-A-G-C-H-N-O-N. That particular Greek word is viscera. And viscera are internal organs. It's where we get our term, visceral. Remember a few years back, I was working with a group, we're trying to define a mission statement of the company, and they wanted to use the term visceral and having a visceral connection to our customers. And there were some who were against it because most of us didn't know what visceral meant to begin with, and we're not quite sure how many people out there would know what visceral means, especially gearheads. I didn't know what it means at all. Visceral. So visceral connection is, so it talks about a gut level connection. So if you have a visceral connection, you have just a gut level empathy. So if we have compassion, like obviously the father having a son when he was having his compassion upon, the father was having the compassion on the son. It was visceral. It was a great sympathy towards. The third Greek word is what's used in the parable, or excuse me, the beatitude is E-L-E-E-O, L-E-A-O. And that's the root. That's the root. Mercy. And by adding full, as in merciful, then that's what's used in the Beatitude. Adjective. Those who are merciful. Being concerned about people and their need. Merciful. Sympathetic. Compassionate. The only other time that this particular Greek word, not the root, but merciful, the adjective, the Greek version of M-O-N on the end of Eleo, is Hebrews 2:17 for your notes. It describes Jesus Christ as being a merciful and faithful high priest. So when we talk about being merciful, I believe it's a combination of these three terms. Obviously, we need to have a sense of compassion. We need to have a visceral connection, a love. But then it goes on to the act of being merciful. Once again, it's just not enough to have pity. Oh, I really felt sorry for that cat trapped in the snare. I really felt bad about it. I didn't really do anything about it, but I felt bad about it. I had a lot of compassion. Being merciful, we can only be described or have that adjective put on us if we act, if we demonstrate and show our mercy. It's interesting to note the placement of this particular beatitude. If God says, or through the Beatitudes, first humble ourselves, then put a proper perspective and balance, that we are to be meek. We seek God's level of judgment or His righteousness, His ways. If we do all those things, we now have a knowledge. We have a knowledge of God's ways. We have an example that's been given to us on how we should act and how we should behave. And through God's grace, His love, His gift of these things for us, we have a knowledge, do we not, that is a result of His grace, of His plan. We have a knowledge of a full understanding of His commandments. But it's a plan, it's a grace that is reserved for all of mankind. Not just for those here and now, but eventually for everyone. That's what we celebrate each year with the Holy Days. So we have this knowledge, we have this understanding. So then what is our approach to those who have not been blessed with the same path? Or those who are as far along on the path? We have the knowledge. We have the understanding. We now know the difference between right and wrong. We're seeking God's righteousness, His ways, knowing we're not there perfect ourselves. But what is our approach to those who have not been blessed with the same path or as far as along the path? What is our approach to them? Are we merciful? I believe that's why Jesus Christ gave it in this order, why He inspired Matthew to record it in this order, is because there comes a point in time where if we are seeking our own righteousness, just like the Pharisees are, that we lose our ability to be merciful. Because after all, we become filled with our own righteousness. They should be there like we are. They shouldn't be battling these problems because they've been in the church for so many years. They should be perfect like I am. Yes, tongue firmly implanted in cheek. So Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 33. Here, to put this in the context, Jesus Christ is teaching his disciples about being merciful, about forgiving one another, to be compassionate. And Peter then came to Jesus and said, well, you know, we should forgive our sins, or we should forgive our brother's sins. How often? You know, seven, up to seven times? And Jesus' response was, well, no, not seven, but seven times seven. Or actually, 70 times seven, I should say. Seven times 70, or 70 times seven. I think it works both ways. If I was just helping the kids on their algebra math, I think that works that way. Anyway, 70 times seven. And he's demonstrating what level of compassion. And then he went on to give a parable about the king forgiving the master a great debt. And what did the master do in return to the slave? He was not willing to forgive a debt that was much less than what he had been forgiven himself. And in verse 33, should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you? And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart. If we think about our traditions in the church, and we think about what's held important to us and the scriptures that we like and hold near and dear and hold up, and those things are all good. But this should shake us to our core. This should scare us. Because as just we read, how many of us can stand before God and said, I did it right? No one. We just read that. So, what option do we have? What option do we have if we want to be there, except to be able to show mercy to one another, to forgive one another 70 times 7? I know that I can be thoughtless, be cold, maybe be aloof, and I've maybe offended people with things that I've said. We're all in some way or another nitpick each other and rub each other the wrong way at one point or another time. It happens because we're human and we spend so much time together and we worship together and we cry together and we laugh together and we plan things together and we plan things differently together, and we're going to offend one another. We're going to sin against one another. We're going to do things that we don't want to do. But if we're to this point where God says, get your mind right, seek my ways, do it the right way, be balanced, but be merciful with what I've given you. Give each other a break. Allow each other to be human and allow each other to grow. We are merciful when we show patience. We are merciful when we allow each other to grow. Now, this doesn't mean we condone the sin. The scriptures are also clear on how we need to address that. That we don't let the sin to continue. But that's different than the mercy that we should show each other. That's different than being merciful. Because as we read, God expects it of us. It's just not a simple, hey, it might be a good idea. But we talk about, for example, the model prayer, where it's very clear, God says, forgive each other. I will, you know, as I've forgiven you. Forgive each other as I've forgiven you. And it's just we read here, if we don't show that same mercy, my heavenly Father will also do the same to you If each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart. Definitely those who are merciful are blessed because they see that mercy from God and they see that mercy from each other. So that's the finish of part 3, and we'll pick it up with the next parable next time. Have a good Sabbath.